listed by name.
Compton, move to approve.
Second.
Second.
All right, we have a motion and a second from Compton and Sayhaw respectively. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? It's unanimous. Next order of business is, does anybody have any revisions or corrections to the June 16th, 2022 meeting minutes that were posted electronically? If not, I'd ask for a motion to accept the minutes as they were posted.
Michael Compton, move to approve.
Michael Stivers, second.
All right, Compton and Michelson, respectively. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? It's unanimous. Just to check, has any committee member joined the call who did not respond to the initial roll call? Okay. Then let's go ahead and take on our substantive issue, which is to hear from our principal investigators on the final report of the development of wind-driven rain climatology and coincidental wind speed return maps for Florida and surrounding coastal areas. Forrest Masters from UF, you're on,
right,
sir.
Thank you, Jeff. And on behalf of Arte Gaetano, who is with the NOAA Northeast Regional Climate Center at Cornell, and Brian Belcher, who works on there, we're pleased to be with you today. In a minute, I'm going to hand the reins to Art, who's going to give the presentation. I just want to remark that I think this is really important work. This is a great team. We came together. I think we looked at the nuances of the problem. We pulled together some amazing analysis. It's also one of the, as you're going to see some of the results, you're going to look at it and say, why didn't we do this 20 years ago? And the answer is we probably couldn't have. We didn't have the high-resolution data. We didn't really have an understanding of the nuances of working with the changes in instrumentation over time, but that's actually built into this analysis here. So we hope you find it useful. I hope you're going to see a lot of science here, but very much grounded in how do we use this information to, say, evaluate the hygrothermal performance of a building, or even looking at the water penetration resistance requirements, you know, for component cladding systems. We can easily connect the dots back to this work. And with the project that's moving forward this year, this project can be very helpful in helping sort of set the tone for what we're trying to do there. So with that, let me hand it to Art, and I'll be on here to take questions with him afterwards. Art?
Thanks, Forrest. Good. I guess it's afternoon for everybody on the call. Good afternoon, everybody. I guess we'll jump right into it. I think Forrest gave a good overall introduction. I guess for our title slide here, he put them together, and being the humble person that he is, Brian Belcher left his name off of it. So I do have to give credit to Brian, who basically was the brawn and a good part of the brains behind a lot of our work. So just to refresh everybody's memory, in general, our project had these six tasks, basically ranging from data acquisition to quality controlling the data and eventually archiving it. We did a significant amount of work. We'll see in the presentation, actually, probably more than I anticipated going into it. Barry had some other thoughts in terms of adjusting the wind speed to account for sighting differences of many of the weather stations. And then we went into our classic extreme value analysis that we'll talk about a bit. We had a component where we compared what we did with 1 minute ASOS data, 1 minute data from the NOAA weather stations with hourly data. And I think you'll see Forrest again kind of cut to the chase there a bit. This was definitely a project that we feel would not have been possible without these 1 minute data. And then finally in the end, looking at the development of the risk.
I think you did. Were you able to hear me before? Because there was a little bit of pause after that.
Jim, can you mute that person, please? It's Commissioner John, if you go ahead and mute him, please, for us. Thank you. Sorry about that, Arthur. Go ahead.
Oh, no problem. Thank you. And then kind of maybe cutting to the chase, what our results were, again, to reiterate, the use of the one-minute data was critical compared to using the hourly summaries, and really that resulted from a lot of differences, discontinuities in how the hourly data record has evolved through time. In the end, we were able to develop what I think are pretty concise functional representations of coincident wind and rain return periods. Our results are generally consistent with results from other data sources that don't account for the coincident rain, but just look at, you know, ASCE7, which is looking at just the wind extremes, particularly when we look at the results that are not specifically for hurricanes in some of those regions, right? We didn't do any additional modeling or anything like that. I think actually an offshoot of this project will be some interesting work on the, again, the standardization or adjustment of the extreme wind speeds for their different directional components. And then in the end, we were able to kind of put this all in a nice, tidy GitHub repository, which essentially has all of our data, all of our maps, all of our functional forms or formats for our functions and return period curves. So kind of data acquisition, we ended up looking at an 11-state area to, again, count for things that were not specifically in Florida, but kind of view this as a region to see if our methods were consistent across the region. And basically, you see the distribution of stations here that had 1-minute wind and rainfall data and had at least a 15-year period of record. Several more stations that had less than 15 years, but those short periods of record inhibited us from doing our extreme value analyses. In terms of quality control, I think the bottom line here is the data were actually of pretty good quality. When we implemented a number of quality control checks, in the end, we ended up removing less than 0.01% of the available minutes. And just kind of rough numbers with all the stations and 15 years of data, we're actually talking at about 8 million available minutes of data to look at. And you can see by the color bars, you know, in most cases, we're removing less than 400 of those minutes. Just real quickly, what we did for screening the data is we removed any physically implausible values, negative rainfall, negative wind speeds, weird wind directions, things like that. We checked or corroborated all of our 1-minute precipitation with daily radar estimated rainfall. So yes, 1 minute to daily, but basically we in no way wanted those 1-minute values to exceed the daily values. That did occur in some cases, but again, you know, a very, very, very small minority of stations there. We also checked the 1-minute wind speeds to make sure they didn't exceed any of the daily values reported in the hourly record. And then we also looked for peak winds that exceeded 30 knots, but there was no gust reported. So that's kind of an internal consistency check with the NOAA reporting. And then beyond that, we flagged any minute that had more than 0.3 inches of rainfall or a wind speed greater than 80 knots. These were at the very extreme end of the spectrum. And then we manually looked at those to make sure they were coincident with what was going on in the weather maps in nearby stations. And kind of a look at the standardization. I have a busy figure here, but basically in the period of record that we looked at from about 2002 to the present, the first thing that pops into the equation here is there were two anemometer types in place, the Belfort anemometer, which was your typical spitting cups, and a Vassalia anemometer, which had a different response. So that was the first thing we needed to adjust for sighting based on a lot of forest work. And then also, we also looked at the characteristics around each station. So what I'm showing here is an example of Mobile, Alabama, and basically I have a Google Earth picture of the site, the instrument site in 2008 and also in 2020. And I think the thing you will notice is in terms of the surrounding area, the lack of trees in the circle here in 2008, and through time, those trees have grown. So we have a lot more vegetative cover in this quadrant of the curve. And really, looking, this is the Vassalia period in the record, And what we see is this wind adjustment factor increases through time as the vegetation comes into play. So the idea here is that coming from those directions, the increase in vegetation is affecting the fetch of the wind, actually acting to reduce the peak wind speeds. So we need to put in this adjustment to account for that period of time. If I look at kind of a blow up here of the different wind directions from Mobile, again, the idea is that there is this change in the two different anemometer types. So this is Belfort, this is the Vassalia, so we have to increase the adjustment in the Vassalia era, coming from the wind directions that aren't affected by the vegetation. And again, in the absence of this land use change, we'd really just have a step change. So we'd have a constant correction or a constant adjustment in each of these periods. But in those areas where the vegetation has grown through time, we see this more of a trend, and this is a significant trend, so we have a variable adjustment through time for winds coming out of those directions. This is Mobile, but we can apply this, or we did apply this, to any of the stations that we looked at. The net result of this is, again, using, I believe this is Tampa as an example. So the idea is we have each of the wind directions. We have a gust factor, which comes out of the work of Masters et al. And then we have a multiplier based on that gust factor. So this is our adjustment, and it's a function of, we have this standardized wind speed. It's a function of the raw wind speed and this multiplier value. And this multiplier is a function of both the gust factor, the wind speed itself, and the height of the anemometer. So here we're looking at these multipliers for a 20-knot wind and an anemometer height of 30 meters. So you can see from the different directions, these come from about a 9% increase to, in some cases, as much as a 50% increase in wind speeds from specific directions. Then the next component of the work was the extreme value analysis. So a lot of different figures here, but we'll focus in on basically each of these panels represents a bin that had a specific rainfall amount associated with it. So if I look at this one here kind of in the top middle, this represents all minutes in which there was 0.02 inches of rainfall at Tampa, in this case, is my example. So over the 15-year period, there were 15 such minutes. Over this 15-year period, there were 642 such minutes in which there was 0.02 inches of rain. And then what the histogram shows are the wind speeds that are associated with these periods. So basically, you can see there are lots of minutes in here where the wind speed was about 20 knots when it rained 0.02 inches, and kind of hidden fewer wind speeds or fewer high wind speeds during these rainfall conditions. So we have this series for any number of the rainfall amounts. You obviously pick up fewer values in your sample when your rainfall amounts go up. That's the 1 minute rainfall again. So we have this for each of our rainfall bins, and then we fit a statistical distribution to that. So that's shown by this blue dotted curve. We did evaluate several extreme value distributions. We looked at the GEV, we looked at the Fouché. We ultimately came up with the Gumbel as being the best representation of the extreme values. We also did the extreme value analysis in a slightly different way. In this case, these are all wind occurrences with the precipitation greater than 0.02 inches. In the second way we did it, we did more of an extreme value approach with a partial duration series where we only looked at the highest, if we're using 15 years of data, 15 wind speeds, and then fit an extreme value distribution to that. And again, in our behind the scenes analysis that we outline in the supplement of our report, those methods did not prove to be a good approach to this, and really the reason why is we had a lot of variability between these coincident rainfall bids. So if we put this all together, we ended up with a lot of graphs that sort of look like this. So we'll see these a few times in future slides. So I'll give you kind of a lay of the land. Along the x-axis is the 1 minute peak wind speed in knots. Along the vertical axis is the 1 minute rainfall intensity. So if you kind of maybe pick on this 0.05 rainfall intensity, what we're basically doing there, if I go back, is we'd be looking at this graph. So these are all the 0.05 minutes with 0.05 inches of rainfall. And then we fit this statistical distribution in blue to the wind speed observations. And by knowing this statistical wind speed distribution, we can find from this distribution at what point are 50% of the values less than, or 10% of the values less than, or 1% of the values less than. So if I use that 1% threshold as my example, that would be something like the 100-year storm. There'd only be 1% of the values exceeding that. If I use the 50% value, that would be something like the 2-year storm. So when I go to this, basically each of the different colors, the different dots represent the different return periods. A 1-year storm in red, the 5-year storm in green, the 25-year storm in purple, and then in the gray, this, the second to last one would be the 100-year storm. So from that graph, I would basically say for 0.05 inches, the probability of the 1% probability corresponds to a wind speed of about 78 knots. The 20% probability, or the 5-year storm, would correspond with a wind speed of about, like in this case, about 50 knots, a little bit more. So that's how you would read these graphs. You also notice the dots versus the triangles. And the difference here is that it has to do with sample size. So basically, for these high rainfall intensities, there weren't enough events that were coincident with high wind speed. So basically, we could not analyze, say, what the 25-year storm was in association with rainfall values greater than about a tenth of an inch a minute. However, we would like these curves to be smooth. We'd like to estimate what is the chance of getting something like 0.25 inches of rain with a given wind speed. So in order to do that, we flipped around the analysis. And if I go back to these where we're looking at rainfall bins and different wind speeds, we flipped the analysis around and we looked at wind speed bins. So we might look at a graph like this for a particular wind in knots, and then did the histogram on the different rainfall amounts. So that gave us these dotted values here. So basically, instead of the triangles being the wind speeds associated with a given rainfall intensity, the dots were basically the rainfall intensities associated with a given wind speed. Kind of the reverse of the analysis. And as you can see, especially when you look at this low return period, the 1-year return period, where they overlap, there's good agreement. So we can kind of fit a nice consistent function across these. And even for the higher return periods, the 5, the 10, we have these gaps here, but we can smooth through those and get a nice functional relationship all the way up even to the 500-year storm. So with that as kind of the premise, we did fit those relationships. Again, we tried a number of different representations. The best came out to be a cubic polynomial. So basically, our functional form looks like this, where I can predict the rainfall intensity for a given wind speed and return period based on an equation that looks like this. So I basically am fitting these solid lines to the points on the graph. And in the end, that becomes our final product for these graphics. So we basically can do those for any of the 100-plus stations that we were able to look at. The majority of them, particularly the ones in Florida, were very well-behaved. And what I mean by well-behaved is this cubic polynomial was a very nice fit across the rainfall and the extreme wind speed return periods. When we moved further west, primarily onto the plains, the functional form was a bit different, where kind of the rainfall intensities were kind of flat. So we did fit a functional form to that, but in this portion of the graph where we're looking really at the rainfalls, it's more or less a constant value. That's why these curves are pretty much flat and parallel, and then the wind speed polynomial picks up as we go further down. I think one of the reasons for that is, if you notice, nowhere near as much rain. We had to cut off our analyses at 4/100ths of an inch in places like Texas, where it's drier, as opposed to exceeding 1/10th of an inch in places along the Gulf Coast and in Florida. So again, our final product that's kind of neater without all the dots looks like this. And again, the coincident wind-driven rain, we would say, all right, if I'm worried about a rainfall intensity of 1/10th of an inch, take each of these contours as being a return period. So in this case, the 10-year return period wind speed that's coincident with 1/10th of an inch of rain is about 40 knots. If I go out to 100-year, the 100-year return period wind speed that's coincident with a rainfall intensity of 1/10th of an inch is about 59 knots. So that's how you would read these graphics for each of the stations. Kind of to shift gears and look at our comparison with hourly data, what I'm showing here is just a particular day in November for Daytona Beach. The dots are the peak wind speeds, and the green bars are the minutes in which rainfall was reported. So one of the problems with doing this in hourly data is, one of the issues here is, here's the highest wind speed during this period of time, and that would be recorded as, say, the peak wind speed in this hour, but that wind speed did not occur in coincidence with any rainfall values. And actually, the hours that did, or the minutes that did show rainfall, actually had substantially lower wind speeds. So we have this mismatch in timing if we don't have each minute of data that are now available from the ASOS values. The other thing that comes into play is how wind has been reported through time on an hourly basis. So before, the premise of using hourly data is we'd be able to have a much, much, much longer period of record. The hourly record extends back to about 1950. However, the problem is before 1973, the only thing that was reported was the instantaneous wind speed at the top of the hour. So it was a snapshot of the wind conditions when the observer went out in the maybe a 5-minute period at the top of each hour. From 73 to about 1998, an additional piece of information was available, and that was the wind gust. So if the wind gusted to a higher wind speed during that 5 or 10 minute period that the observation was taken, that was recorded. So that gave us a better estimate of perhaps the more extreme winds. And then after 1998, the orange bars show another value that was available, and this was the peak wind. So the peak wind was at any time during that hour. What was the highest? I believe it was 2 minutes, the highest wind speed in a 2-minute period that was reported. So we were no longer constrained to what was going on right at the top of the hour, but we could look at least the wind speeds across the hour. That still didn't help with the rainfall values, however. So as a result of that, if we look at different ways we can use the hourly data record, the top shows the maximum hourly wind speed that we constructed from the 1 minute data. So basically go into this 1 minute data for each hour, pick out the highest wind speed for the period that we have 1 minute data. And we get a distribution of winds that look like the upper graph. However, if I go back down to the bottom, and it's the same thing, but instead of being derived from the 1 minute report, it's what's available from the hourly reports. And what you see is a lot of very low wind speeds, a good representation of the extremes up above about 23 knots, because those are those peak wind reports, but actually a dearth of wind speeds in this 10 to 20 knot range. And that's because peak wind only has to be reported if the wind is greater than 23 knots. So in these cases, we're just kind of stuck with the top of the hour values with no wind speed reported. If we bring in the other periods that had peak winds and gusts, kind of get different values. These middle periods fill in, but you can see using the hourly record, the take-home method is there's many, many more small wind speeds because we're being limited to the sample of hours right at the top of the hour, as opposed to if we were able to look at any 1 minute period in the hour, we better sample these more extreme wind speeds. So really in the end, we had to rely on the hourly data, we'd be grossly underestimating the wind extremes, and really there's it's an apples and oranges comparison between what's available with the 1 minute data. So kind of just there a written summary, but the idea here is that really it's the availability of these 1 minute ASOS data that really makes this coincident wind-driven rain analysis that we've done possible. And then last but not least, where are all the results from our analysis? So we're going to maintain a GitHub repository of all the data. The URL is there. And basically what you'll find here, or what anybody will be able to find here, again, an inventory of the stations that we use, all the raw and standardized wind speed return period curves. Those are the curves that I showed for Tampa, so they're there for each station. The fits to each of the functions that we fit the return periods for on those maps. So those are the A, B, C, D coefficients in that cubic polynomial. Maps, so basically here's spatial maps of the different return periods that are contoured. That was a project deliverable. And then some differences on whether we standardize the wind speeds for the different directions and gust factors or not. So the GitHub repository looks something like that, arranged as a number of different folders for the different values. The final report is included there as well to keep everything together. And just to kind of step through at the end, you know, the folder that has return period curves, here's the one I showed earlier for Tampa. There would be one for that for each of the stations that we analyzed. The maps would look something like that. So here we have a different return periods and then different rainfall intensities. So this would be the 100-year wind speed for at least 1/100th of an inch of rain per minute. And we have a contoured map there. So the darker areas are greater than 90 knots for that value. And then the coefficients table is basically an Excel spreadsheet that looks something like that. So I think with that, I'll leave you with the URL. And I guess protocol is to open it up for any questions.
Right. So does any committee member have any questions they'd like to ask? Or comments?
The other thing I'd like to add is, although it wasn't one of our deliverables, definitely in the process of formulating a peer-reviewed paper on our work, and that's hopefully will appear in the Journal of Applied Meteorology and Climatology.
Great. Forrest, do you have anything to add?
No, actually one thing. You know, I think there's going to be a lot of interest, obviously, you know, how do we extract, you know, engineering information from this for, you know, water penetration test standards, that type of thing. And it's probably not the time to get into that right now, but I just want to make sure we open that door. I certainly think that's going to be a prime subject for discussion on the next project very early on. So if in the meantime you have any questions, please don't hesitate to follow up with me directly on that.
Right. Well, if no members have any questions, and if there isn't any public comment, if there is, please identify yourself. If not, then I would ask by name for a motion to accept the final report.
Vince Hayhouse, motion to accept the final report.
Compton, second.
We have a motion and second to accept the report. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? It's unanimous. Well, thank you very much, both of you, Art and Forrest. Appreciate the presentation and the good work.
I thank you all for the opportunity to do the good work. Thank you for your feedback through the project. It's been, like Forrest said, it's been a really neat project to work with, and look forward to seeing an application.
Okay. Mo, do you have
something? Hey, no, I'm fine. Thank you, guys.
Okay. Then Commissioner Schock, are you still on?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Well, I would rather you just say we stand adjourned and adjourn the meeting.
Okay, yeah, that's no problem. First of all, is there any public comment, any additional public comment or staff comment or committee comments?
I have a comment. This is Kathy Krafka-Harkema on behalf of the Fenestration and Glazing Industry Alliance. We would like to thank Florida for funding this research. We think this is exciting to have additional data to make informed decisions and judgments on, and we really appreciate the efforts of the Florida Hurricane Research Advisory Committee in ranking this as the top project last year, and also the Florida Building Commission in agreeing in the funding. And this is a prime example of some research from Florida that's going to prove a lot of good benefits for many aspects of informing better building design, product testing, installation, and maintenance going forward. So we want to say thank you, Florida.
Okay. Any further comments? Hearing none, we can stand adjourned. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks,
bye-bye.